Hey, Bobby Manning here, and welcome back to Dome Theory. Been a couple weeks, got a couple interviews lined up here today. This is an awesome episode of returning guest, as well as a new guest who I've been meaning to chat with for a long time. She's been mentoring me for a decent amount of time at this point, probably a year, year and a half. I've known Mirren Fader, who many of you probably know as well, for her incredible features, vibrant paintings of the personalities in sports, whether it be the Ball family, Andre Drummond recently she wrote about, Phil Handy. The characters and visuals off the court that you may not know as much about, and she has honed in on Giannis Antetokounmpo to the level where she'll be writing the first definitive biography about the future potential champion here. In these NBA finals, it didn't go well in game one, but he's back on the court, played fairly well considering a major knee injury that he sustained a couple weeks ago now in that Eastern Conference finals that knocked him out of game five and game six. I enjoyed game one. The Suns are running on all cylinders, so the Bucks are going to have to really hone in on the offensive end and find a way around that Phoenix defense if they're going to even want to compete in this series, because the Suns, if you look at Vegas now too, betonline.ag, our sponsors here at Dome Theory, have the Bucks as heavy underdogs to win these NBA finals now. If you go to their series prices, game two is tonight. You can get the Suns right now at -280 on betonline.ag. If you think the Bucks can come back, they're only down 1-0. You can get them at 235. Make sure you go to betonline.ag. If you want to bet on this series, the game tonight, Suns enter -4.5 with an over-under of 221. Our friends over at betonline.ag appreciate them filling us in on the odds in this series. Yeah, I don't know. I hope the Bucks can make it more competitive than it seemed in game one. The Suns, all those pick and rolls, mid-rangers, and switches killing the way that the Bucks want to defend. I thought the Bucks played all right defensively. Devin Booker never really got going in this game, but Ayton's dives, 8 of 10. Chris Paul's shots all over the floor, including a dagger three late, just terrorized them. And Paul, you would think right now, running away with finals MVP. I'll get to my MVP picks in the series that I made before game one. I really love the odds that BetOnline was offering from that perspective. But we'll get into that once we talk to Mirren Fader about her Giannis book, which is coming out August 10th. Make sure you get it on Amazon, wherever you buy your books. She is offering a special deal. You can get a signed copy if you go to her Twitter, from Mirren Fader of this book, if you buy locally, which is obviously something she's passionate about and wants you to buy from her partner, small business in her area. I'll get you the link to that on our Dome Theory page on Twitter, but make sure you go and get Mirren Fader's Giannis, The Improbable Rise of an MVP, which is out August 10th. I've pre-ordered it. I'm going to get it from that bookstore as well. Mirren Fader is the second half of our discussion here today. First half of the show, we are talking about Tyler, the Creator's Call Me If You Get Lost. Really the most exciting release of 2021 so far. I know we have Vince Staples coming out tomorrow with his follow-up to Big Fish Theory, which I loved in 2017. So it's been a little while since we've heard a proper album from Vince Staples. A few singles here or there over the last couple years since I was a freshman in college and loved that Big Fish release. We now get a Tyler release 2 years after Igor won Rap Album of the Year. That's a big theme on here. Life after that grand success, a bit of a victory lap here. Call Me If You Get Lost, 10 years of one of the most influential hip-hop artists ever, certainly of the last decade. The way Tyler, the Creator, has molded fashion, production, rap topics, per se, as well as the approach to a hip-hop album with Igor, I think we're going to look back on him as one of the most creative minds in hip-hop history, certainly befitting of the name Tyler, the Creator, and his latest release, no different. I'm here with Jason Buford, who is going to break down this album with me. I've listened to it about 15 times now. I can't remember listening to an album, about 2 weeks out now, as many times as I have this one, at least once a day, pretty much every day since it came out. So that brings me to about 15, I would say. This album is well produced, has a thin concept, but a strong one, I think, and is just great song after great song. What's Your Name, Juggernaut, Corso, the expanded intro, DJ Drama's on here, gives it a bit of a mixtape feel beyond the sporadic jump between aesthetics here. This album is incredible. I still like Flower Boy more. I thought Flower Boy was perhaps his strongest performance as a rapper yet, and Igor was his most creative project. I love the approach that he took on that album. It's sitting behind me right as we speak. I'll be getting that Call Me If You Get Lost album certainly as well, but the visuals on this album, I know Tyler, after we recorded, just released a music video for Lemonhead. That song, I love the bridge between that and other songs on this album, as well as his perspective on the early years of his career, his upbringing, why he shifted the way he did around the time of Cherry Bomb is addressed on this album, and some strong features from the likes of Pharrell. Lil Wayne, for the third time in Tyler's career, drops a unbelievable verse in a guest capacity on this album, and you also get Frank Ocean appearance on the back end of Lemonhead, some strong singing by various singers, a few female vocalists, as well as Brent Fires on this album, and I guess A$AP Rocky was supposed to be on Corso. That's something Tyler talked about in his performance of this one, but the rollout's been incredible. You think of the videos, the visuals, the billboards that were associated with this release. I'm going to leave the rest of our conversation to Buford and I. As in a way that you can help Jason Buford, who's a good friend of our show here. We talked to him about a year ago about Alfredo. Make sure you go over to his Twitter page at Jason Buford and subscribe to his Patreon. He is now independently releasing hip-hop music writing as well as a little bit of sports writing, he says, and some other topics that come across his mind as well. He's been featured in Pitchfork, among other places. A great music writer. And we are talking to him right now on Dome Theory, number 53, I believe. So, yeah. Tune in with us every week. We're talking music. We're talking the biggest news in sports, topic in sports. Obviously, the Rachel Nichols drama is still unfolding at ESPN. We got the finals going on. And then the NBA offseason. Check out our latest Garden Report on CLNS Media. We talked about the Bradley Beal path that's starting to sizzle, boil, whatever you want to call it. There's at least rumblings that could be a path that the Celtics take here in the next year or so. So we'll find out fast if that's how they're lining themselves up, because there's certainly a number of personnel moves that would take them out of the running for a move like that. And then we have the draft coming up, summer league, all that stuff. Hopefully I'm going to have some more pieces of my own producing some independent sports journalism here. Stay tuned for that. But Bobby Manning, Dome Theory 53, subscribe, get it on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher. That's the best way you can support me for right now. And here is Jason Buford. Welcome in. Afternoon edition of Dome Theory here on CLNS Media. If you're tuning in live, you can see me. You can see Jason Buford, who we talked to about a year ago. I think the last record we talked about here on Dome Theory, because we're going to get into a little bit of a review today, is was Alfredo.
Yeah, we did Alfredo. That's right. We did do Alfredo. That's right.
Freddie Gibbs and the Alchemist, which Tyler the Creator appeared on. Probably one of my favorite tracks of last year, Something to Rap About. And a string of Tyler features. He was on Pray for Paris. He was on that Brent Fires record.
Yeah, we kind of should have known that this was coming because of those verses last year.
Yeah. And the billboard, there was a good rollout to this between last year's features, The billboard that people saw around LA probably about a month and a half ago, and then the array of videos and singles that came out. This was a great rollout to this record. Call Me If You Get Lost, Tyler's sixth album. Rave reviews everywhere. It's not going to be too different here. I just love this record, and I was talking to Jason before we got on. He had a lot of good things to say about it as well, but that rollout was a good way to get started. Four great videos, good snippets, good songs, I thought, to choose to go with as far as singles went off this record, and a lot of visual stuff like we usually get from Tyler.
I actually didn't even know what to expect, right? Like, I remember I had heard that had come out, I seen the video, and his visuals are always really great, but I didn't know what to expect when it came to the new album. I didn't think it was going to be a hardcore rap record. I thought it was going to be more of the neo-funk, neo-soul direction that he had been going. I thought he might build upon that and do a little more within that, but I didn't think he was going to bring it back to kind of the Wolf era, Tyler. So I was pleasantly surprised.
I wasn't expecting that either. I mean, Lumberjack did kind of sound like that, the first single. Just a great hardcore track. The sample on there is awesome. I can't think of the artist off the top of my head, but it was an old hardcore rap song that, he kind of reshaped in his own direction there. Call Me Lumberjack because I wish you would. That refrain in the chorus there. But What's Your Name? And this is something we just talked about before we got on here, too. The complete opposite when we talk about like the different shades of Tyler's music and the different, subgenres that he's dove into here, that kind of falls more in line with the Flower Boy Igor Tyler. And that's a track that really got me excited and ultimately became my favorite on the album. You didn't hear the NBA Youngboy verse that it landed on the album after in that video that dropped. But I thought that played well. I'm not a big fan of him, but I thought he fit so well on the song. And brought a nice melodic rap verse. I'm not. I gotta listen to a little bit more of him. I'm just saying, like, I haven't heard enough of him and gotten into him. Yeah. So he was one of a number of artists on this album that 42 Doug, a handful of others here that I really haven't dove into a ton. I like Lil Uzi. I thought he fit really well on here. But a diverse array of features, diverse array of sounds on this record. And What's Your Name ultimately was probably my favorite song on here. Ty Dolla $ign came through with the nice outro vocals back in Tyler's high pitched ones there. And, it was just a fun track that, at a minute, 2 minutes, really, is one that has great replay value. You can listen to that song over and over again just because of how short and sweet it is.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for me personally, when I listen to the album, it's a very well produced album. But and that's that's no secret. But what's also really great about it is there's different types of beats, right? You have a lot of the soul samples that are in the vein of Tyler kind of doing his own West Side Gun impersonation, which he seems like he's been really
a couple West Side Gun samples on here too.
Yeah. I think he's definitely been influenced by Griselda a little bit, and then you have him going with Corso is a huge boom back revival type of track, so and Wilshire's kind of like going back to like the DJ Drama days in general, and so like Or rather, Lemonhead, not Wilshire, Lemonhead. Lemonhead's like the DJ Drama type of track. And so I think for me personally, it has a large musical landscape in it, but not in kind of the way that you would expect, not in that type of like, rock, neo-soul type of way, but in hip-hop in general, right? This is kind of Tyler's love letter to rap, it kind of feels like.
Yeah, and he's a really good rapper. I wasn't blown away by the technical rapping on here, and he's not the best rapper in the world, but he's really good. And when he goes in,
he can rap with anybody. Right? Yeah. I think he's not, he's not, Ghostface Killer, MF Doom in terms of just like the way he kind of had the alchemy of his lyrics or anything. But what Tyler's really good at is he has a lot of command of the voice and a lot of command of what he's doing. And so like, he's more than capable of carrying an album like this because of his voice and because of his presence on the mic.
Yeah. And that's something he did well in the past, on Flower Boy especially went away from rap for the most part, even though he won Best Rap Album on Igor. You know, not much rap on there at all, just in terms of, you know, the genre itself. But he does get back to that here quite well. And, you know, the opening track here, you mentioned the Griselda influence. I didn't recognize the Michael Irvin sample on here initially. I was trying to, like, just process, you know, what was, like, original instrumentation on here. When we get to Hot Wind Blows, I was like, is that Tyler on the keys? There's no way that's Tyler on the keys. And it wasn't, but it was a really good sample. And Sir Baudelaire here too creates a world. And this is what he does most strong as a rapper to me, the imagery, building a character again. I feel like this Tyler Baudelaire thing he does here is similar to the Igor thing that we saw on the last album.
Sometimes he's really good at crafting the album without being corny. Yeah. Right? His albums always have concept to it, but they never seem corny.
No, and the way DJ Drama supports that, I was one of the people on here, of course. Like, yeah, there's a little too much DJ Drama on these tracks for me.
There's never enough DJ Drama, man.
But yeah, once you start to see, hear.
We'll fix that. I got to send you some Gangsta Girl tapes. There is never enough DJ Drama in this world.
Once I started to hear how he contributed to the character building on here, just kind of like that narration of the album, especially on track two. The first six tracks on this album opened it so well. And, you know, Corso is another favorite of mine on here. Drama, I need you. Like him and Drama going back and forth on like that bridge to the end there. And, you know, just the lyrics on here, too. He starts to build that story with, you know, the love triangle that he eventually gets to by the end of the album here. He introduces it on the second track. And he's so damn funny. He really is. Like, not many rappers just have you, like, laughing mid-track.
He says this line. He's a very funny rapper. And I think that was always his calling card when he first came out. And then he kind of went away from it a little bit. If you listen to, like, Flower Boy and you listen to Igor, these are very, quote-unquote, mature albums that are kind of talking about, like, real feelings of sexuality, real feelings of just, like, change within the body. But back on this album, I think he got back to kind of the biting sense of humor that he had on his first three records.
Well, just these 1-2 liners that he has, and he had a few of those on even those more mature tapes, but this one had me laughing my ass off to open up Corso, especially when you see where the album goes. He ain't talked to his bitch in 3 days, and ain't gonna be this way. I'm down for the threesome.
Yeah. He's also very, he also has like these phrases that are really funny because no one else in the world would say that. No one else in the world would tell a woman, you look malnourished, but tell you know what I mean? Like,
that's a great line, too. And I love French toast. So the French toast imagery there, I was just so fired up to hear that. Like, he really does incorporate the little things, too. Like, on that opening in Flower Boy, I thought these lines were so similar to open each album. He's talking about, I was never into the beaches and all the sands. I was in the woods with flowers, rainbows, and posses falling out of my pocket, but you want to know if I swim to cool down? Just like the image of lakes. Yeah. He did this on that Freddie record too, Cars. That's all over this album. You know, driving, scenery.
A lot of motives, right? A lot of things are all over this album, but underneath it all is a love story. Uh-huh. You know what I mean? Like he can, you know, these yellow yachts, the French sun, you know what I mean? It's like I might have got that mixed up, but he's really good at like having these like motives and these things and these visual like just ideas and then packaging them together to make a whole love story, to make a whole story of what's going on with it, right? And for sure. I think in terms of crafting albums, Tyler's one of the best doing it right now.
Yeah, and I thought the 2-minute tracks really worked well with that too. Mm-hmm. You know, we're going to come
out. Very quick paced album, right? There's a lot of tracks on this record, right? So I think we got 16 tracks on this record, but you wouldn't feel it with the runtime. Every track is quick, but it's still meaty. It's not like it's like a 25 minute album or anything. It's a 53 minute album, but the tracks are quick. They're concise. It's a real tape. I mean, you can't say anything more.
Yeah, no, people talked about the mixtape feel to this one, especially with Drama being integrated. We're going to talk about a lot of Kanye parallels here. And like at this point, am I crazy to say this? I said this to some friends the other day. You know, after this 3-album run that he just went on, 3 real deal contenders for Rap Album of the Year, and one, and this one probably could too, if we look at what's out there this year so far. he's really putting himself in a Kanye kind of space when it comes to his production acumen, the materials that he puts out there, the videos, the clothes, everything that goes into these releases. And then on top of that, great rapping, great production, feature choices. I really see him entering this Kanye echelon of creativity that, you know, is a high bar. I'm not going to say he is Kanye at this point, but like, if you're going to pick anybody to be in that same breath, I think at this point it's fair to put Tyler at that spot.
I mean, if you look at an album like Igor, you can consider that to be like an album like Yeezus or something like that, right?
Yeah.
Or you can consider that to be something like 808s and Heartbreaks, rather. Whereas like this, I think it's definitely his Might Before Doctor Suspense, his universal beloved record that everyone can kind of, that he's been waiting to for it to make his whole career, and not everybody can really get down to. I see that as, I see Call Me If You Get Lost as his Might Before Doctor Suspense. However, I think they're totally different artists. They're not necessarily the same. They're, what they're both really, really elite at is putting guest features in the right place. I will say that. And that's something that they are both great at. But other than that, I think they're dramatically different artists and have dramatically different careers. Like if you remember Kanye, I mean, The Dropout is I guess you can say Bastard is acclaimed, but in a much different sense than Kyle Dropout is, right?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Bastard was, you know, Odd Future wasn't loved by everyone, right? They were very good. You know, people recognized the talent, but also it wasn't like universally acclaimed like the Kyle Trapper was when it came out, right?
Well, no, it was a different time in music, because this is what makes
it was a very so different time in music in general. Yeah, but I mean, their careers in rise has not been the same. It's not been in the prestige eyes the same. I think it took Tyler a while to get to that level where he was respected prestigiously, like Kanye.
Kanye had to carve out a role in the industry.
Yeah.
You know, doing that work with Jay-Z and all the production features and stuff like that, finding his radio hit. Tyler didn't have to do that. They could just put their music online, and that's how people found them. You know, he never had a – and, you know, Yonkers obviously blew him up, but that's an internet hit compared to Through the Wire, which was, you know, a huge radio hit back in 2000.
Yeah, I mean, Through the Wire had been on the streets forever, right? You know what I mean? It's just like – it's just really the accident. It's really after the accident that had to come out, and then Dropout came out like a year later, right? So it's just like an entirely different type of era, entirely different type of career, and like how it jumped off, right? Like, I think Tyler legitimately just started his own shit.
It's crazy too. I mean, that's like 8-9 years apart, and the music industry transformed forever in that time.
Our Future was like on those blogs and shit, right? You know, like Pitchfork, Beat It Drop, blogs, and like official style blogs website, but still, it wasn't like, you know, it wasn't like the run had come from him doing you know, a Jay-Z album, right? The run came from kind of his own lonesome, kind of, you know, this alternative group got together and they just got popping, right? It's like, so I don't see that many similarities, but the similarities I do see are very pertinent, right? The ability to put people in the right positions, the musical scope, the idea that you can make an album and then kind of keep kind of progressing visually and progressing musically from there or whatever. You know what I mean? He is a combination of Pharrell and Kanye.
Pharrell is the one you got to include in there for sure, because that's obviously his biggest influence.
I mean, even there's even records on this album. I mean, we talk about Cherry Bomb. There's even records on this album that are just like Pharrell's Gangsta to Girl Tape. You know what I mean? Like, it's, or the Clips Gangsta to Girl Tape. It's like, those are Tyler's favorite rappers, right? Those are Tyler's favorite rap people.
Juggernaut, that's the one that stands out to me most in that vein. Mm-hmm. And obviously Pharrell appeared on there, but that and many other tracks on here. The other thing that sticks out about this record to me is the transitions. You talked about the great production on here. The thing that sticks out to me most are those just diversions, transitions, shifts between track to track. That stuff here was beautifully done. And
I really respect it too, because, you know, Tyler's taking DJ Drama and his, and you know, these classic mixtapes and making it into like album cinematic form.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And that's like, I think that's really dope to combine. I think that's really dope to, not that DJ Drama, not that DJ Drama's legacy needs that, but to bring DJ Drama and bring that, you know, to bring Avant-Garde to the hood. Like, I think that's a great job by Tyler. I think that's the music he was born to make. That's the bridge he was born to gap, I think.
You have these great moments on this record too, where Drama is just kind of going along with like wherever this is going. Like there's some tracks here where Drama fits right in. Then he gets on "I Thought You Wanted to Dance" and he's just like, "Welcome to the disco." Yeah. Like we're just gonna roll with this.
I like to think about the ice cream. I've eaten ice cream like this whole time or something like that.
It's like Tyler's just handing him a script and he's like, "I'm just gonna do this."
We wouldn't get like classic Drama, but he's in rare form here. He's very good here.
He was amazing. Yeah. It was so easy for me eventually to get into his inclusion on this album and how prevalent he was. That transition on Juggernaut, though, there's some great ones on here.
Pandemic is a great question, by the way. I think that intro was great. Oh, you want to see Pandemic? Like that's.
We should have ranked his best ad libs on here.
Yeah, I don't know why everyone's thank you for giving me some pitch ideas. I don't know why everyone's ever done that. I don't know if they've done that yet.
Speaking of that, Jason Buford, great music writer. He's going all in on that now as a career. He's doing a Patreon with music writing. Go subscribe to that. We're all going to hop on there right after this episode and subscribe. I put it in the chat. I'll do it again. I'll drop it on Twitter. Make sure you go get Jason Buford's music writing.
I do some basketball stuff on there too once in a while. And I do some movie stuff on there once in a while too, but mostly music journal. So I appreciate it.
Yeah, for sure. I appreciate you always being willing to come on here and chop it up about these records. These transitions on here blow me away. And that one on Juggernaut, really, because the record starts as one thing for about three bars and then just goes in a completely different direction. Yeah. And you know, when you hear people reacting to it, it's like, is this going to be one of the slower songs on the album? And then all of a sudden it just explodes in the video too.
Yeah.
Transitioning, and then you got Wilker
after that, which is a song with like a whole story and a whole kind of wrapping up the theme. And it's like,
so that's like, where, that's where the album kind of hit a bump for me. The storytelling's great.
Yeah,
you know, the rapping on there and the imagery and just the emotion on it, I think is awesome. I'm just not really that interested in the story. And it's so long. Like, that's not a track I'm going to be running on repeat. I mean,
it's definitely like one of those Magnus Opus type of songs. It's like, you know what I mean? He's definitely trying to make his like version of like Stan or something like that, for sure.
Yeah.
But I think it's rare nowadays to see a rapper really trying to rap like that.
Yeah.
A rapper who's as popular as Tyler, it's rare to see them try to go in with 40-something bars, 60-something bars. We need that. We need that. He's barred the fuck up. We need that. You know what I mean? So I think definitely, you know, 8 minutes, not for everybody, but for me, like, I wouldn't have any other way. That's hip-hop right there.
Yeah,
I think this album is his love letter to rap, and part of that is the imagery and the storytelling and those 8 minute songs that like Nas would make or something like that, you know, something like that, you know what I mean? And I think he is trying to bridge from that to the gloss and the, you know, utter sensational pop music that he makes.
Yeah, for sure. It is interesting to see on an album where we talk about the 2-3 minute tracks, the 1 minute interludes here, to have an 8 minute, you know, just bar track, really like almost in like an MF Doom vein, no choruses here, just boom, 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 boom. I love the technical aspect of that track. I'm just not as interested in the content there. Probably just because of relatability factor. I never really been in a love triangle. So, you know, I do not recommend
Bobby. I do not recommend.
It just doesn't speak to me. Maybe I'll get there one day.
I do not recommend love triangles.
It is interesting because Igor came out, or at least Igor was still running routinely in my life during a hard breakup. And I think that's still like why it appeals so much to me. So part of like the way these albums call it to you is like, what's going on in your life? And, you know, do you need a grasp on something like that? So, You know, that's just something that hasn't come up yet. We'll see.
Well, see, that's my problem. I don't even break up, bro. I find myself in love triangles.
Yes. There you go.
That's on me. Yeah. That's probably why Will Smith. That's probably where I like Will Smith.
That track was for you. Yeah, I love Sweet. Obviously, I think Sweet was Tyler's favorite song on here that he did. A really good
set, right? Yeah.
Yeah, really good. A bridge to the second half of the track. 10 minutes here, and it really doesn't feel like it. You talk about the runtime of the album. The runtime of this song just flies by. It's great. You have different voices coming in and out. Brent Fires, I thought, was awesome on here, transitioning in the second half of that track. You get a little keyboard segment, and then you go into really, like, how would you classify I Thought You Want to Dance? Like, that's something like I've never heard Tyler even approach in terms of sound there. You know, some like island sounds, I'd say.
Yeah, I mean, that's like his world. That's like him making world music.
Yeah.
I want to see Tyler, like, I want to see Tyler's at that point now for me. Like, I want to see him do whatever he wants. If he wants to make like world music, I want to hear that. You know what I mean? I think he proved himself so much the past 2 years in terms of like, yo, a lot of niggas can't really fuck with him. And that's really a fact. And so he can do it all. So that song doesn't even surprise me. Yeah, I mean, he's got it, man. He is who he is.
Yeah, I'm blown away by the level of creativity here, because you talked about what were the expectations coming in this album? Like, what could you do after Flower Boy was so well received and Igor wins the Grammy? A lot of it was pushing his boundaries even further, just in terms of...
I think one of the hardest things to do is to show creativity but still have a base of something, right? To still have a core element of something. And here he's showing immense creativity within a core element of one broad thing. But that core element is at front and center in every single song. And that's very hard to do. Because we've heard rappers, right? Like someone just put on Life in the chat, Ed Rose, my man Ed Rose, just said Life in the Day of Benjamin Andre, right? So like, we've heard The Love Below, right? But the thing about The Love Below is that the core element of what made Outkast blah, 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 or great, or, you know, whatever have you, is not in The Love Below. Whereas the core element that made Bastard, Open Our Eyes, and Odd Future's music in general is here. And I think there's a difference between making an album that's not within the genre, but it's quote-unquote creativity, and making an album that is rooted within the core elements of a genre, but it still like has such a wide musical scope. And I think Call Me If You Get Lost is that. And so,
yeah. And to not feel like it's bouncing around too much. You're all over the place.
Yeah. It's really great.
Seamless. And that just, honestly, I thought he performed well on here in terms of the singing, the rapping, the writing, all that stuff. But what stands out most is the production. To loop all this stuff together that you have here, you know, condense the tracks down, make the features fit the way they did. It was just like, I thought Igor was amazingly creative in terms of production, but this in terms of like what you got to do to make an album come together, like executive producing per se, was his best job yet by far.
Yeah, definitely was. He's a great A&R person of his own albums, right? I mean,
Yeah.
I think he's a great A&R of his own music. That's the biggest thing. He has always historically put people in really good positions. Wayne, he always does a really good job with. So
we saved the best for last. Hot Wind Blows, his best song ever, maybe.
I don't know about ever. Rusty's pretty great. And Glorious from Bastards is pretty great. I don't know about ever, but it's a pretty good track.
So production choice here, the jazz sample that you have, very MF Doom-esque, rapping on the, you know, keyboard segments there.
I thought that way as well.
Yeah, obviously his idol. Lil Wayne hopping on the feature track, best feature on the album, best verse I've heard from Wayne in a little while, and he's had some really good ones the last few years.
He's had some really good ones this year in general. I mean, he's really good on Seeing Green. Wayne can still get there, man. Wayne can still get there. Wayne is a top 10 rapper of all time. Wayne can still get there. And I'm proud of him. I'm always happy to see Wayne do well, man. Always. So Yeah, it was good. It was good to hear him on that record. He really killed it.
Good as chemistry.
Usual, great rapid fire wordplay as usual.
Yeah, the last four bars here. So just rapid fire, turning up the speed, you know, bouncing off the beat too. That's this is a hard beat to rap to, and he just makes it seem seamless. Him and Tyler really, I thought just trying to one up each other a little bit here in terms of their verses. Like both of them are so sensational. You know, Tyler's trying to still establish that storyline, the scene in Switzerland, all that stuff. I love how he just keeps plugging that name in there. We boated here. It's Tunchi and Tyler, but call me Baudelaire. I love that. Like he just keeps reminding you, you gotta stick to this character that we're going with here, Tyler Baudelaire. I'm sure we're gonna get a lot more visuals too. Lil Wayne plays along with it great here. I just love this song. This is one that's gonna be on replay for a long time. But yeah, that's basically the album that we have here. It's a quick listen. I've listened about 15 times. It's easy to just run it back. As I've said, it's not my favorite Tyler album. That's always going to be Igor. I think I got Igor right there, the record. Yeah. That one was awesome. Just never heard anything like it. I think it opened a whole new space, world, genre almost that I've never just heard anything like, and that to me creatively and just conceptually I thought was really one of the coolest albums I've heard an artist put together. This one's great though. It's right up there with Flower Boy. It's right up there with that one. And he had one of those rare three album runs. You know, you think of Kendrick's three album run and you know, some of the other greats that we've heard. He's really put himself in a special place as an artist now, and I'm thrilled to hear what he's going to continue to do, because
Flower Boy Igor, I didn't think about that. You know, Flower Boy Igor, Call Me If You Get Lost is a pretty good three album run. I mean, it's not the best of all time. It might not even be like a top 10 or top 20, but it's like this for this decade. Yeah, it's up there with Kendrick's. There's certain, maybe even better than Kendrick's. It's really good. It's a really good three album. It's really good. I mean, I would say Call Me If You Get Lost and Wolf are my two favorites, but out of that three. Call Me If You Get Lost, Igor, and Flower Boy. Yeah.
So I'll have something coming on this tomorrow. I'm definitely going to write about this album. You got anything coming on it?
I'll plug it. I'll retweet it, man. Yeah. That's awesome.
For sure. Yeah. This one's, there's a lot here. I mean, we could have gone for an hour and a half, I think, on this.
It's such an expansive record. I mean, we didn't even get to the idea of him kind of reckoning with this type of stuff. The type of, you know, language, the type of words that made him popular, right? The type of content that made him popular. You know what I mean? It's really interesting.
Grappling with his space in the protest movement on Manifesto and just how, like, he doesn't really feel, you know, like he's required to say something or do something. And, like, I thought that was interesting, his commentary there. Because
And the juxtaposition of Tyler being this kind of shocked by the artist, and now after the popular success, him becoming one of those artists where like, hey, Tyler, speak on something. You know what I mean? Like that juxtaposition is different and like psychologically doesn't really make any sense. Like, you know, and so he's like kind of wrestling with that.
Yeah. His mom's on here talking. Like you have some victory lap tracks on here, like almost like you would think like a retirement album with some of the tracks on here that are just like, I made it, I did it, blah, 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 blah. You know, those ones were solid, not my favorite tracks on here, but really there's so many layers here. And I think that's another reason I've listened to it over and over again. Like what am I missing here? You know, throwing some good headphones in here, like him talking in the background on Sweet, like saying to bring the bridge in. This album's got a lot to it. And, you know, I think pretty much everybody who listened to it enjoyed it. Rare agreement, I think, across the board in terms of loving this album. Because, you know, I had people who didn't like Igor at all. It was just too different for them in terms of what they expected in the past from Tyler. So there you have it. Probably the best album I've heard all year. Anything else sticking new out this year so far? Records that you're loving?
Records that I'm loving. Really like the Herbal album. Really enjoyed Pray for Haiti, Matt Kami, and West Side Gun. What else?
Tyler, I like the Rosenberg album that came out, the compilation.
I did like the Rosenberg album. It's actually good. Yeah, I did like the Rosenberg album. Yeah.
You had a song called Marcus Smart. Never thought I'd hear that.
Arm and Hammer dropped a really good album. Yeah.
Saba continued to do great stuff.
There's been some good stuff. We're only getting started, though. Isaiah Rashad's coming up soon. Vince Staples coming up on Friday, so.
The Offseason, did a review of that on here a couple weeks ago with
That was okay. Yeah.
With my guy Jordan Rose over there at Complex. That was a good episode. If you haven't heard that, go back and check that one out. Good stuff from Cole. I thought he kind of just tuned into like what he does best and didn't try to do too much, and it worked into being a solid album. So that was another one I enjoyed this year. And, you know, we got concerts coming back. I'm going to my first concert in probably 2 years in a couple weeks in New York City.
Oh, yeah, bro.
Rock Marciano and Stove God Cooks. That's going to be a good one. First time I'm seeing
that. Yeah, I might see you there.
That's down in Sony on 42nd.
Yeah. Rock Marcy's one of the greatest of all time. So,
and Stove God Cooks, I'm loving it. If you haven't heard of him, you gotta check that guy out of Syracuse. Kind of a protege of Rock's, so it's fitting they're gonna do a show together here. Yeah. His debut album was sensational, very underrated. The Underground Writers have done a great job covering that one though. So, Jason Buford. One of the best music writers out there on the TL right now. Go get his Patreon. I'm going to plug it again on Twitter right when we get off of here. Subscribe to Dome Theory as well.
I have a Pitchfork review come out today. So,
Pitchfork?
Yeah.
Yes, sir. Yeah. We'll link to that as well. What'd you review?
Juicy J's album.
There we go. All right. We'll be sending that out there to everybody. Get that Patreon. Get Dome Theory wherever you listen to your podcast. And we'll see you again next week. Check out our conversation with Miren Fader as well. Talking about her Giannis book coming out. That's going to be an exciting read in August. We got the NBA Finals going on right now, and he is back. Played solid last night, but the Bucks lost, and I really don't think the Bucks are going to get that title, which I wish, like, that would be so great for his resume to win a title here. Phoenix is gunning on all cylinders and just destroyed them last night. So it looks like they're going to roll. Thank you, Jason. Awesome conversation. Again, get his Patreon wherever you're able to access his social media accounts, namely Twitter. And don't forget, Dome Theory, brought to you by betonline.ag, the official betting partner of CLNS Media. The NBA Finals are tonight. As I said in the opener, Suns, -4.5. I'd take it again tonight. I really would. I love the way they're playing. They're healthy. I know Dario Saric went down, but their core pieces are healthy and rolling. Devin Booker, if he plays any better tonight, it'll be even easier for the Suns to win going away in this one. Once it goes back to Milwaukee, we'll see. Could be a different story. Over-under 221, so we're talking about 111 each there. I'd go under in this one. I know the last game was over. So there's my picks for tonight. Series, obviously, you're going to get the Suns at -280, Bucks at +235. We have some game props here as well available for Bucks, Suns. Do you think the Suns win by 3 to 6 points? You can get that at 500. If they win by 10 to 13 points exactly here, you get +600 as well as a 21-point plus blowout. Also being sold at +600 here. A close Bucks win, +700. That might be your best value there, 3 to 6 points. So those are some specials that are available here. NBA draft prices are out now. Cade Cunningham, -2,500 to go number one. So if you think anyone trades up, if you think different switcheroo is pulled by the Pistons here at that number one spot, you can get Evan Mobley +1,000 as well as Jalen Green at that spot. NBA player futures are out as well for awards. Finals MVP, Chris Paul, running away with the favorite at -210. I got him at +150 here on betonline.ag in the opening of this series. So I was ahead of the game. But if you think the Bucks can turn around, Giannis steals that MVP, he is available at +340. Great odds for him. Devin Booker, +400. Ayton is down to +2,000. I got him at +2,500 in the opener of this series. I love those odds as a long shot MVP candidate here, hedging a little bit with Chris Paul. He went 8 of 10 and is still shooting 70% from the field in these playoffs. If he slows down Giannis on top of that and shows to be a centerpiece of Phoenix's defensive dominance, and Paul slips up a little bit here, I think he's a strong long shot candidate here. You can still get him at plus 2,000, which is sensational odds. So go check those out. You got some NBA series props here as well. Just tons and tons of stuff that you can bet on. Do the Bucks backdoor sweep the series? You can get that at plus 2,200. There's so much to bet on, even as the NHL season ends here and baseball still firing away. So there are plenty of baseball games to bet on. Still Euro games in Europe that you could bet on as well as here. Don't sit on the sideline. Get in on the action. Don't forget to use the promo code CLNS50 and receive your 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. Bet online, your online sportsbook experts here, as promised. On Dome Theory 53, Miron Fader talks Giannis, his journey from Greece to the NBA Finals, where he's playing tonight out in Phoenix. I love this conversation. If you want any of these visual versions of these, go check it out on CLNS Media and, of course, subscribe to our podcast here, wherever you get your podcasts. Here's Miron. Miron just wrote the biography of Giannis Antetokounmpo, the first that we'll see of his legendary career here. And that's what I'm going to stress throughout this. Like with stars in the NBA now, we've become so over like critical of them, and you know, are they going to win a ring? Are they going to get it done? Are they going to break through? That you almost lose sight of the other achievements, the defensive players of the year runs that he's had, the MVPs that he's piled up at this point. But the disappointing playoff runs have been kind of the theme of his career so far. So you really do hope that he can break through here and get his flowers per se by finally winning that chip. There are so many interesting things about Giannis that I want to get into here today, but we'll start with you. Your journey to this point, your writing career. I think you've told your story well in a bunch of different places, but so I'll kind of have you do the quick summary here. You know, going to a small school, playing basketball when you were young, taking on this profile approach that you do, the personalities, the life, the, you know, relationships, all the different like background things about these people that you write about in the basketball world. I love the way you do it. It's unique. It's different. It's refreshing. And what ultimately, after all these profiles, all these different athletes that you've written about here, led you to say, all right, I'm going to write the book about Giannis?
Yeah, I mean, thanks for that. I think, you know, with long form stories, you always want like something very human oriented. You know, it's got to be more than just like, oh, so-and-so is really good at basketball or really good at football or, you know, whatever sport that I'm covering. And Giannis, of course, I just feel like there's so much missing between, you know, really tough childhood and NBA MVP. So it's just kind of like, why do we really know nothing? And so for me, it came out of a profile I did on Giannis and his youngest brother, Alex, for Bleacher Report, where I previously worked. And I just observed the chemistry between both of them being at Giannis's house. And I just thought, okay, this is a book. You know, and so with long forms, you know, my story is you have to stop at like 4,000 words, but a book is like 100,000 plus words. So it was perfect to like have the time and the space to talk about those things.
So how did you, what was that process like? Because this is something I'm trying to do too, is get from writing, you know, those short articles off like news, games, like little things into longer pieces. You know, you talk about 4,000 words there and then eventually get into a 100,000-page book. How do you start to write longer and, you know, go further and stretch these stories out the way you do?
Yeah, I mean, I started out at a newspaper, the Orange County Register, and they would like cap me at like 800 words. Like writing 1,000 was like very exciting, you know. This is like, oh my God. And then if we get to like 1,200, it's like, whoa, 1,200, you know. So I think it's just accepting that like it takes a long time to be able to do the work that you want to do. I was doing that for like 4 years, you know. Mm-hmm. And it was hard because I felt like they cut the soul out of each piece and I wanted to continue on. So I just started pitching. And I think I mentioned this to you the other day. I was, you know, you just got to pitch to people and say like, this person deserves a longer story. I'd like to write on this person. And freelancing is kind of how I started. I would freelance in my spare time for ESPN and Bleacher Report, SB Nation, a lot of places. And then finally I got picked up by Bleacher Report. So, but it was a long time as a freelancer, you know?
What was that first story where you broke through that 800 word mark there? What was like the first one where you really got to go long on someone?
You know, it was interesting. Cal State Fullerton was one of my beats, and they're really known for baseball. They're like this small market program that always goes to the College World Series. And but nobody was covering their softball team. And this new coach comes in and she's trying to take over the program. And so I did this long form on the softball coach, and they were terrible that year, but in like 6 years they became conference champions. And I went back and she had the article like framed on her inner office. And I was just like, stunned, you know. So it felt really good to get a longer story there.
So when did you finally start covering Giannis with this story here on Bleacher Report, and you know, started reporting on him for the first time? It's interesting, I never really heard about Alex. You hear about the Nassis and Costas and the NBA guys here, but his younger brother is sort of who you profiled here.
Yeah, so that was 2019, around like the summer, like June, July. And my editor was like, you should look at Giannis's youngest brother, Alex, because like Alex was really good at the time. And he kind of did all the stuff that, you know, Giannis does. Like, they're very similar in game. And I think Alex even has a bigger wingspan, allegedly, even in high school. And so, yeah, I spent the day with them in, I think it was June 2019. And I don't know, I was just really taken by them. It stuck with me. You know, some stories just like really stick with you. And the story came out later that summer, and you know, people were just like, I've never seen that side of Giannis. It was like a more vulnerable side of Giannis, or getting into his head a bit. Cause you know, people really only talk about Giannis at the time, just in terms of like his physicality. You know, oh my God, he's such a freak on the court. Like the missing was like, who is he in terms of like being nurturing or all of these other qualities. And so I felt like the piece did that. So concurrently, I had been trying to write a book for a very long time, maybe like 5 years. And I finally got introduced to the right literary agent who was interested in representing me. And a couple of the stories I pitched like didn't work out. But when this came out, he was like, I think this is the thing. So I wrote the proposal later that year. And then it was like shopped around to different publishing houses early 2020. I signed the deal March 2020 when the world shut down. And then I had from March 2020 to March 2021 to do the book, which is insane. Usually you get 2 years. I got 1 year.
So you had that background reporting from 2019, but when the world shut down, it becomes a little bit tougher, I'm sure, to get the kind of like access and interviews and visuals there that you would want. You know, it was really the easiest time to get an interview with someone, because you could just hop on the computer there and do it. But at right. the same time, you couldn't be in all the places you wanted to, I'm sure.
Well, it was crazy because even before I signed the deal, I was just like, I need to go to Milwaukee, just because I was like nervous. It's my first book. So I actually went to Milwaukee right before the shutdown, like literally a week before Corona shut down in the US. And I got the brothers again, and I got the family again. So that was like very, very lucky that that happened. And then I went to Sacramento because the Pistons were playing the Kings, and a lot of former teammates were on the Pistons at the time. So I got a bunch of people there, and then I came home, and then they shut down all US travel. So I was very, very lucky, but it was still really hard because I wanted to go to Greece and I couldn't go to Greece, obviously. So yeah, WhatsApp became my best friend. I was up interviewing people in Greece at like 6 a.m. my time, Pacific, and you know, it would be nighttime there. And I just, yeah, I got through the pandemic just reporting 24/7.
Did you need any Greek translators along the way?
Yes. Oh my gosh. I got to know a Greek translator very well. And this person like really helped me out, not just in terms of like interviewing people, but you're working with like secondary source material, like trying to find all the articles ever written about Giannis in Greek. And like, I definitely got help from people for sure. But, you know, there just wasn't that many because he wasn't destined for success. You know, he was like in this awful league and nobody really thought twice about him. He was kind of an afterthought. And so it's very interesting to find, you know, the 10 articles ever written about him back then, which is like insane, you know?
It's unbelievable because this story of him, it really has a little bit of everything. There's like nationality, identity, poverty, just all these different stories of life, and really the way the game has gone international at this point that I think this reflects too. You just read some of the stories of his come up there, and you know, like there's just so many little tidbits. The fact that he had to change his name from Adetokounmpo to Antetokounmpo to match with, like, you know, the Greek society there, but like even all those little things, his basketball interests and, you know, their, you know, push to work hard there and all these different things really didn't break through and have them become accepted there. And really, like, one of my favorite basketball stories I've ever read was that New York Times piece about how, all right, now he's this MVP being celebrated in Greece and the Greek Freak and all this different stuff playing for the national team. But when he was there, you know, he wasn't able to become a citizen. He wasn't able to, you know, his family wasn't able to get the civil service jobs. He didn't become a citizen until a couple of years before he went to the NBA draft. And you know, they just had to fight so hard to belong there in Greece.
They had to fight so hard to belong there. And also that there's just so much revisionist history about how people felt back then versus now. And one of the parts of the book that I enjoyed reporting was finding his childhood best friends. And there were a couple that were also Black Greek and undocumented, and sort of charting their careers and non-careers and just how they weren't able to ascend in the way that he was because they didn't get their papers expedited. You know, they weren't 6'9" at the time. And so looking at the way that his friends' lives really diverged really gives you perspective on how lucky Giannis got and how improbable it was, and how quite sad it is for everyone else who is Black and Greek and can't get basic, you know, rights in life. So I just thought it was interesting to kind of use them as a way to learn more about, like, all the, you know, the obstacles that Giannis had, because it really wasn't going to happen. I think that's what people don't understand, is that he was one event away from not making it. It was always like one thing away from not making it. It was never destined. It was never like supposed to happen.
What was the turning point you think that led him to break through and, you know, do what was so unlikely there?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a couple things. First of all, like, the NBA does its homework. Like, these scouters are not going to Greece to find talent. They've identified him as talent. Now it's just how good can he be? So I think, first of all, like, credit to the whole international scouting community that just sees these people, even though you don't know what they're going to turn into. You know,
even in like those lower leagues in Greece.
Right. No, it's like actually insane. And so, you know, credit to them. But I think as far as like the other things that allowed him to break through, it was a perfect storm getting drafted to an awful team where there went, you know, everything goes wrong. Everyone gets injured. They won 15 games. And he just luckily gets into the lineup because they're so bad. And so what if he gets drafted to another team where he doesn't get to play and develop? Would he become Giannis? I don't know. Like, I think it was a perfect storm, like, you know, being in a small market environment where they actually cared about him and was there for him and supported him and allowed him to play through his mistakes. Like, that just, I think that allowed the breakthrough, because I don't know if that would have happened with another team. They want you to, when you get drafted, you need to be ready. Like, this idea of development is really like a far gone concept.
Yeah, no, it was stunning. I still remember the day you got drafted, and it was like, could this guy be like way later in the draft? Could he be up at the top? And he ultimately landed somewhere in the middle there, and the Bucks took a chance on him. Of course, like, here in Boston, it's still like, oh, the Celtics could have got him. They drafted Kelly Olynyk over him. And okay. At that time, like, no one would have been waving a flag to draft Giannis. It would have been seen as like such a massive gamble.
Totally. Okay, so one of my favorite anecdotes from the book, I talked to Austin Ainge, and he was telling me how, like, they, so, like, basically Danny, Austin, and, like, a bunch of Boston people not only came to Greece, but they traveled to this place called Volos, which is, like, you know, like, 6 hours away or something crazy like that, and the crowd was, like, yelling at Danny and, like, saying mean things, and he's just, like, so confused, like, why are these people, like, why is everybody saying these things to me? And he doesn't know what they're saying, because he doesn't know Greek, and then finally... somebody tells him that they're taunting him, and because they've mistaken him for a rival Greek GM. They don't know that he's Danny Ainge, but once they realize he's Danny Ainge, they start cursing and saying things about the Lakers, and it's, you know, and then they all start cracking up, and it's hilarious. Imagine like this, you know, little gym in the middle of nowhere, and Danny Ainge is getting like shitted on by all the people there. It's just like very funny. And then they come to a practice the next day, which was just like all the players were like, oh my God, Danny Ainge came to our practice, you know, and it's just a huge deal. But, you know, what they basically said was like, if we knew Giannis would have grown 2 inches, it would have been a different story. He would not have fallen to where he fell at all.
What made the Bucks believe, like, what, you know, there were all these different concerns about him and questions, and you could project greatness there, but what made, you know, whereas I think it was 15 teams passed on him before that, what made the Bucks commit to him in the end, you think?
So that's the weird part, is that, like, especially talking to people like John Hammond, you know, the GM at the time, and a lot of the staffers, is that they were fully aware that they were taking a ginormous chance. Like, this wasn't something that they, like, John is like, I'm not going to act like I knew something that others didn't. Like, I'm not going to act like I have these clairvoyant powers and I knew. So I think first just saying that is like, they took a humongous swing, but you can do that when you're the Milwaukee Bucks, and you had to do that when you're the Milwaukee Bucks, because keep in mind that, you know, they were almost going to leave Milwaukee. There was concerns about, like, could their arena be a modern day NBA arena? Could they leave? Look what happened to Seattle. So they were in this position where they could afford to take a chance. And it's not like you were top five. You could, you know, if this didn't work out, it would be okay. You know, 15 is a whole lot different. And so I think a couple of those things made them feel comfortable, but they liked what they saw of him. Scouting him was incredibly difficult. They couldn't tell the size of the players on the court because the film quality was so terrible. So imagine, like, everything is against this guy. You can't even tell if he's that good via film, but you're just taking a chance. And so it was a big chance, but, you know, credit to them for actually doing it, you know?
I remember I was covering Syracuse and they took like a summer trip to Greece, and I was trying to find like these Facebook streams to watch them. And it was just someone with like a handheld recorder, like 15 rows back, like trying to find the ball and who's who there. It is crazy. Some of the film work that the, you know, scouts there have to work with and go off it. So who was some of the most interesting, or what were some of the most interesting interviews you did writing this book? Like, what were some highlight moments, quotes, you know, people that you talked to through this process?
Yeah, I think, okay, so I interviewed 221 people, so there were a lot of interviews, but I guess breaking them up into like sections, the childhood best friends were amazing, and he's still close with some of them. I think that I kind of just didn't, I knew how hard things were for Giannis, but I didn't know how vulnerable he was and how emotional he was and how, you know, he used to cry after games or just feeling so low and sad and not knowing what was going to happen. I think the childhood friends like really illuminated that for me. And then talking with Josh Oppenheimer, who's a current assistant coach with the Bucks, I really love talking with him because he was their rookie year and they were so tight. Like, that's his guy. And I think that, I'm not sure if this is the exact quote, but I know it's in the beginning of the book. And Josh said, like, you know, Giannis works as hard as he does now because he's afraid of losing everything. So I think that, like, that's his mindset.
There's my dog.
Okay, I got to know the dog's name.
Sophia. I knew she was going to make an appearance one day on this show.
So cute.
She's dying to go enjoy the sun, so we'll wrap this up. But I still have a ton of more questions here on Giannis. That childhood, you know, I think you described, like, them sleeping together and just, like, the, you know, tiny living space that they were in. And, you know, the difficulty of survive day in, day out. I think Thanasis had to, you know, go out and steal some things. And, you know, his parents were always looking for jobs. And Giannis was doing what he could to just put food on the table. And, you know, there's an interesting anecdote about one of his coaches saying that, like, you know, he's got this great basketball potential and we can do all these different things to, you know, fulfill that. But today he's got to eat, you know, like, What was that experience growing up for people that don't know it?
Well, Giannis didn't want people to feel sorry for him. So he never said to his teammates, like, hey, we're struggling. There was one incident, which is a pretty big moment in the early chapters of he just didn't eat anything the whole day and he fainted on the court. And that's when everybody was like, oh my gosh, like, you have to start eating. And he just never wanted anyone to feel sorry for him. So he's, you know, and they're also not the type of people that want to burden anyone or ask too much. And so out of the kindness of the teammates' hearts, you know, they helped in the way that they could, but they weren't rich either. So it wasn't easy for them too. But yeah, I think it was really hard for Giannis to develop his basketball skills as well, because there were stretches of time where he'd just have to leave with his family to go sell trinkets to make money. So he'd be gone like 2 weeks and then come back for a couple of practice and then leave for a month and then come back. And so it was just like very unstable. And this is when he's like 15, 16 years old. And finally, you know, the coaches get him to stay. So again, it's like, you know, a prospect that isn't fully on the court 24/7 at age 16, and that is like extremely rare, you know.
Did you get to interview Giannis for this?
I interviewed him for the story that I did, which this was born out of. Mm-hmm. So this book has that interview in it.
I do find that interesting, because most of the time when you're writing a book, and I know you did get him for that story, but you don't really, I talked to Jeff about this a lot too, Jeff Perlman, like, you don't get the subject himself. And it feels like that's almost fine, because, like, you know, that prospect of it, did you want to like do a full interview with him for the book itself and like the full story here? Because it almost seems like that's too big of a interview to have here. Like, you can get like everybody in the world around him, and that almost does like a better job of, you know, writing the book than having to like come to Giannis and be like, all right, I'm writing your biography, and like have that discussion and like everything that comes with that. Cause a lot of times it feels like subjects are almost like unreceptive to someone else writing their biography, especially now where everyone wants to write their own documentary and produce all the own content about themselves and all that kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of subjects want to get paid, but that isn't, yeah. You know, that's not journalism. Like, you can't pay your subjects. So yeah, there's a lot of like as told to by, which is not, you know, the work that I want to do right now. You know, I want to do like real journalism. But the interview we had was great. And, you know, it really, it colors the book. There's a lot in there from him. So I felt good about that. And then I interviewed the family multiple times. So like I mentioned, that trip to Milwaukee. So I think just spending a lot of time with the brothers, you know, because they're so close to him. So I felt like those interviews like really were illuminating as well. So, you know, of course I wanted more, like every writer wants more time, but all things considered, yeah, I felt really good. I mean, nobody else has interviewed the mom, and she's in there. So, yeah, I felt like, I don't know, it just gave me the latitude to explore things. Like, I don't know how much of, you know, the racism he experienced they might choose to put in if they were doing an as told to by story, you know? Mm-hmm. So, you know, sometimes you have more freedom.
What was some of that racism, explicit, implicit, you know, that he had to go through there?
Yeah, I mean, so it really wouldn't happen when they had home games, but when they would travel to different places, that's when people would shout like really obscene things from the stands and just horrible. And then even when they just walk on the street, like people would say things. And so there was also this like neo-Nazi group that was around Greece at the time called Golden Dawn, and they would patrol these neighborhoods really like hunting for migrants, and they would beat them up. They would, you know, there were murders there. It's just really awful, xenophobic group. And so, you know, there were moments where Giannis was aware of them, or, you know, so were the brothers, and, you know, you couldn't walk home at night alone. You know, you just always had to be aware. So even though there were like really, really kind, amazing white Greek people that helped out the family, there were also people that did not support them and were horrible. I think people think it's one or the other. It's both. There were amazing, selfless people that formed lifelong relationships with the family. And then there were just like truly awful racist people that didn't care that he was a basketball player. Like, to them, he was black and therefore not Greek, because they don't offer citizenship, even if you're born there. And Giannis was born there.
how did his parents end up in Greece? You know, they were from Nigeria, and, you know, all the kids were born in Greece. What brought them from Nigeria to Greece?
Yeah, Nigeria was really unstable at that moment. Like, the economy was in tatters. You know, oil was one of the biggest exports, and there was just so much instability there, and you know, political instability, and, you know, they needed a new opportunity. And, you know, one of the reveals in the book is that they actually didn't intend to come to Greece. They were going to go to Germany. So they went to Germany first, and then, you know, Charles, the father, was going to play soccer, and then he had an injury that ended his career. And so they went to Greece from there, but Greece wasn't actually originally in the plans. So yeah, they were just looking for more opportunity, better opportunity. And yeah, I think Sapolia is an interesting place to have landed out of all the places in Greece, because it's actually a very migrant heavy neighborhood. So you had people from all different countries. It was really a melting pot.
Mm-hmm. And what are his parents like? You know, I think we have a good sense of the brothers there, because, you know, one plays for the Lakers and one's with them there in Milwaukee. You know, people kind of know who they are. But, you know, what are his parents like?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, I never met Charles because he had died before I did the story. But Veronica was, like, really, really nice, but also really cautious. You know, she doesn't. Oh my gosh.
Sorry, I just had to let her go. She was getting antsy.
That was so stressful. I was
like, you start that over.
what was it? Oh, Veronica. Okay, so yeah. Because she was undocumented, you know, and all these things, she couldn't really trust people, especially coming to the U.S. as well. So takes a little bit longer to warm up too. But, you know, she's very kind and just very supportive, and just loves her children more than anything, and she is their role model. So they saw how much she sacrificed their entire lives, and so they wanted to, you know, repay her in any way they could. And from what I know about the dad, he was super, super selfless. And I know it sounds cliche, but, like, he always had a smile on his face, even when everything was awful. He would always just be walking around with a smile on his face and would always say, "How are you?" to friends. But, you know, he was gone working. The parents were both gone working, like, the whole day and sometimes night. So, I think, like, I'm happy that Charles got to see Giannis turn into what he has, because it really changed things when they were able to come to America. They got denied at first with their visas, and that was really, really painful for Giannis rookie year. So once the family came over, they were all able to just, I don't know, be a lot happier together.
What strikes you about the way Giannis has grown up here over the last 10 years that we've gotten to know him to some degree? Like, you know, you spoke about him being this kind of caring figure in the part, in the family there. And, you know, obviously when you saw him in 2013, he was this skinny, skinny guy. And now he kind of looks like a Greek god. He's just, like, chiseled and just overpowering people. You know, huge head, just a staggering figure of dominance that wasn't always there. Like, I think physically, I get a good sense of how he's transformed over the last 8 years that he's been in the NBA here. But what about his personality, like him as a person, do you think he grew up the most in?
I mean, I think he's opened up more to teammates. He was, like, really private himself. He's always been a friendly, hilarious person, like, very funny. Like, every teammate that's ever played with him has at least three anecdotes up their sleeve of the funniest Giannis stuff, you know. But he's just opened up more in terms of, like, a vulnerable way. And I think it was Sterling Brown who said this to me last year, as far as, like, on the court growth, Giannis, like, listens more to his teammates. You know, he's always, like, a person that, even though obviously he's a good teammate, he works so hard, he believes he can will his team to victory. But now, as a leader, he's learned to, like, listen to other people and lead in that way, and that comes with also being more vocal. So one of the things that he struggled with majorly was opening his mouth, and Jason Kidd was like, "I need you to talk." You know, Jason Kidd was trying to make him into a point guard, you know, and, like, talking is like breathing for point guards. And so but Giannis, like, hated that, like, hated talking. And so that's one of the biggest things, is, like, he's become a leader that leads not just by example, but, you know, vocally as well.
So there's this sentiment against him that, I don't know whether it's because he's not a great shooter, or he hasn't won at this point, or he's just always doing the spin move. Like, I don't know what it is about, like, fans online and their, you know, distaste for Giannis, because I love him. I really do. Like, he's become one of my favorite players, not only because of the personality you talk about there, but I feel like people should love this approach he's taken, where he doesn't want to team up with the other greats in the game. And I know he's got a couple of really good teammates there in Jrue Holiday and Chris Middleton. But, you know, he's not everyone always thought he was going to go to Miami or Dallas or one of these places with other stars, L.A., but he signed that extension through some uncertainty there. And now he has said over the next 4 to 5 years, he's going to try to get it done largely on his own there. I think one of the interesting things about that is this thing that he doesn't work out with other stars during the offseason. He's talked about wanting to, you know, do it on his own and beat the best in the game and this kind of thing. Where do you think that stems from for him? Is it kind of just him growing up in a different culture where that AAU thing wasn't as prevalent here? Or is it just kind of his loyalty to Milwaukee?
I think it's he thinks that, like, why would I give you my secrets? Like, why, if I'm trying to beat you on the court and kill you on the court, why would I give you a glimpse of my tendencies? It really comes from just a competitive aspect. And I think he's, like, very old school in that regard. You know, like, I think it was Josh Oppenheimer who said this quote about, like, Giannis is never going to be on the banana boat. And if he's on the banana boat, he's going to be with his brother.
His brother.
Yeah. When he said that to me, I was like, okay, I get it. You know, and it's not that he's not friendly. He's just, he comes off as, like, not friendly, but he's really just competitive, and it just comes from a desire to not let you see. However, I think there's a limit. Like, he turned down Dirk's the Hall of Fame shooting coach guy. That's a guy that you need to accept an invitation to, in my humble opinion. But he doesn't want to work with outside people. But, you know, he's been really successful doing it his way also, I think, regardless of, like, the slander that we've seen. But I think the problem is, like, had he not been named MVP, nobody would care. Like, they would just still find him adorable and endearing and inspiring. I think once he was named MVP and the pressure, that's when it became enormous. That's when he had different expectations. Might have been, like, one of the worst things, not worst things to happen to him, but it just created a different lens through which we view him.
Yeah, no, and it happens differently now for players. They come in at 18, 19, and especially a guy like him, he was just trying to find his way on that roster. You know, Jabari Parker was the future of the franchise there when they were both getting started, and he had a fight to the top of the roster there. And unfortunately, Parker getting hurt the way he didn't help. And, you know, some other instability there, trying to find the right coach, all those different things. But really, we're just looking at 3 or 4 years now where he could have legitimately won a championship. So we're still kind of very early in his window. I was at game 7, as I told you before we got on here. It was my favorite game I've ever gone to. The atmosphere was electric. I keep telling people that Nets crowd's underrated. And this countdown, or count up, I guess it was, on the free throws, just epic. Like, it was loud. It was a moment, especially after the last year where we didn't have crowds in stadiums, to have that effect there, where you can probably imagine that's tough for him, going to the line, hearing that, getting that 10-second violation called on him in the past, and going through the process that he does there at the line. Like, that was just a moment that I'm never going to forget. And then him airballing the first one, but finishing the game, hitting 8 of 14 as he did, and winning the biggest game of his career. That was so much fun and really felt like a breakthrough moment. We'll see where it goes for him there. But that free throw routine with him, I've never seen anything like it. The stare, like, I'm going to almost try to, like, imitate it. He does the big breath, the stare, the ball's right here, dribbles a couple times, rolls it in his hand. Everyone's counting up there at, like, 12 seconds at this point, goes way above his head, and then just flicks it up there. And, like, there's some games where it works. Most of the time it doesn't. And that's still this thing he's trying to get past, is teams are willing to send him to the line. Like, his shot still, at this point in his career, isn't there 100% of the time.
I just got so stressed as you were recapping. This is what I feel every time I see the routine.
Oh, it's hard. It's hard to watch.
I just feel stress coursing through my body. It's just, it's not good. But that game was just so intense. I was screaming. I have not cared about a team in a very long time. I was just like, oh my God. But Chris Herring had a really good, at Sports Illustrated, he had a really good piece about this. And it wasn't just on the shooting, but he had one line in particular where he was saying that, you could tell Giannis is like thinking because he knows if he drives and he gets fouled, he has to go to the free throw line, and that's not great. So he's mulling over all of these things in his mind instead of just doing it. I thought last night's game, much better job of that, but still, like that play where Trae Young was guarding him and he chooses to do a fadeaway instead of just, you know, where's the hook? Where's the, you know, it's almost like not understanding how big and powerful he is. Or I don't even think it's that. I think he's just insanely coachable and he's been misguided his entire career. You know, they've been trying to make him into a guard, a perimeter person, when he should really be a five. And I think that's like more of an off-season discussion. Like, is he going to fully go into that like AD, or is he going to, you know, keep trying to run the floor? So I think that there's just, it's like a conversation that's been going and going and going, and you're just seeing the problems with it all.
What's that shooting evolution been like for him? Because it's gotten better. You know, he can knock down a three at this point. It's almost, he's kind of lucky. Like, I was watching that game and I was like, is this how he's going to go down? Is this going to be like the latest loss for him, just being unable to hit a free throw and the air balls? And like, I was dreading that conversation with him, but he broke through. And then to some degree too, what we're watching with Ben Simmons bails him out a little bit, because Simmons is in like a whole different level of that shooting, you know, process and just trying to get it down at all. But what's Giannis's growth been like from a shooting perspective? I know you wrote a little bit about that in the book too.
Well, if you look at rookie year, it was not an ugly shot. It was very fluid. It did not look bad at all.
That's what I'm wondering. I'm like, who taught him to do this?
So rookie year, he actually attempted quite a number of threes. So it was not like this was like this awful glaring gap in his game. It wasn't even talked about that as far as the draft either. They were just like, it just wasn't labeled as this glaring weakness as it is now, because it wasn't at the time. And then so Larry Drew gets fired, and then Jason Kidd comes in, and Jason's like, I don't want you to shoot, at least not for the first couple of years. So he didn't let him shoot. And he would, some of the gems in the book as far as like basketball stuff is, you know, Jason Kidd would bench him if he took a long distance shot. So imagine like not being able to do this for a couple of years. It's going to mess with your confidence. It's going to mess with your timing. It's going to mess with like your ability to like, you know, just your muscle memory. You haven't done it. You have a split second between open and release. And he just didn't have that for a couple of years. And I think that really like screwed him up in certain ways. And, you know, Josh Oppenheimer, who I mentioned earlier, worked with him rookie year on the shot. And Josh is known for shooting. And then he's, you know, really just doesn't have a whole lot to do with it after that, because Jason Kidd, you know, wants it his way, and that's the type of coach Jason Kidd is. And it's just like, I think it just morphed into something that just wasn't a part of his game, and then they want it to be part of his game, and then they want him to be a perimeter person, and all of a sudden he doesn't know how, and emphasizing that instead of going to the basket, which he should do every single time, because there's nobody that can defend him when he goes inside. So I think Bud, you know, emphasizing like, yeah, it's analytics. We want you to take these, you know, other shots. It's just kind of like, I feel like does a disservice to his powers.
Yeah, I really hope he breaks through and wins it all here. I'm rooting for them. And everybody's got a take on how he should play, what he needs to do. I think one of my favorite things is Barack Obama was on a podcast with Bill Simmons and was like, he needs to develop a mid-range. You're like, everybody's got an opinion on this.
I know.
How are you, last question here, and Marin Fader's Giannis, the improbable rise of a NBA MVP is out August 10th. I have pre-ordered it. You can too. Go out there and get it. How are you absorbing this playoff run as we go along here? Game one was last night as we record this. They lost, but a long series ahead with Atlanta. really feels like they're probably the favorite to win it all at this point with Kawhi down and Chris Paul in that COVID protocol. Someone tweeted you saying, like, is there going to be, like, a playoff chapter that you have to write here for the soft cover edition? Like, what's – how are you following this playoff run and how are you working through it right now?
Oh, my God. I'm sitting there stressed. Bucks fans, I see you. I understand it now. Books don't sell themselves. So, essentially, like, if the Bucks do well, you know, that'll really help me, which is nice. But so I'm just studying them. I know I'm gonna have to write something for the paperback version. And the Hawks are for real though. Everyone is like, okay, the Bucks are gonna take this, but I mean they're good and they're fun, the Hawks, you know, they're not to be taken lightly. And the Bucks just look super uninspiring. I was just like getting very angry yesterday. Like, can you guys play with more heart? Come on, you know, and they just, I don't know. There's just no urgency, like no closing out, not playing defense, not rotating and just jacking up threes. And it's annoying.
They're frustrating.
It's frustrating.
I had like a checklist in my head because when they went to the overtime in that game 7, I was like, they're going to lose. The way they collapsed down the stretch there and Brooke Lopez holding in the corner, I was just like, oh, they blew it. But been this playoff.
I was like, Brooke, for the love of God, I thought it was over. I was just so frustrated. But
I love all those guys, though. Brooke, love him. You know, being Brooklyn back where he played for so long. Jrue Holiday, awesome guy. Chris Middleton, one of my favorite players in the league. But it just isn't coming together for some reason.
I mean, a part of it's coaching for sure, but also it's just I don't understand the lack of urgency because it's like you're the Bucks. You're never supposed to make it. You're never supposed to get your opportunity, and now you do. And this is the effort. You know, it's just very surprising. But like you said, there's so much talent. Like Chris Middleton is awesome. Like he really is. And like when Jrue gets his rhythm, he's awesome too. But yeah, it's decision making. I don't know. Here's to a better game because I recounting it, I'm getting stressed all over again.
Trae Young's gonna need a biography one day. I mean, this is
amazing.
The shimmy. It was so great. These playoffs have been amazing. They really have. These are the best I can remember.
Why is everyone complaining? It's wonderful.
I don't know. We got to stay off Twitter, me and you, and just enjoy the game. I don't get, there's just so much negativity on there around the league. And it's like, listen, who cares about the ratings? Who cares about how Adam Silver and the business people care about this? Like, this is just really good basketball. And we can all sense that. We can all feel it. It's a little unfamiliar, for sure. You know, LeBron's tweeting about it. LeBron's tweeting about, well, I told you guys, now I'm not in the playoffs anymore. It's like, we'll be fine. We got Devin Booker. We got Giannis. We got Paul George. But again, at the same time, this is a bunch of people who haven't broken through. Paul, Giannis, George, on the Hawks side. They're younger. There's not the expectations there. But someone's going to break through here and finally going to get beloved and get their flowers. And hopefully it'll be Giannis. But Mirrored Fader, thanks so much for being here. Awesome talking to you. Thank you for all the advice you've given me early in my career. I was in the that competition last April. It's talking about quarantine memories where we had to write the obituary and the.
Congrats for getting through that.
My favorite was I got to write about an Italian sub. I think one of the topics was right about food. It was some fun topics there.
You killed it.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me. This was so fun, and we'll have to do it soon. You know, hopefully if the Bucks get their act together. I appreciate you having me.
We'll do it. I can't wait to read the book. I'm still getting through Jeff's Lakers book right now. Anything good you're reading right now?
Oh, my God. This is, as you can see, I love books. But when somebody's like, what's your favorite book or what are you reading? I'm just like, books. I think it's called Of Salt and Women. By Gabriela Garcia. I just started that. I might be butchering the title, but it's really, really good. I'm a total book nerd. But if anybody has ideas for book number 2, let me know.
Hey, I'll send some your way myself. Thank you, Maren. Thanks for being here on Dome Theory. And we will talk to you again here on the show soon.